1, 2, 3, 4, Medium Talk.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Medium Talk. For all the people on the Black Guy Who Tips Premium Network, you know, all my people that subscribe and pay for my money now, thank you so much, guys. You know, I like to go out and talk to interesting people, so today is no exception. I've been trying to land this interview for quite some time. If it wasn't one thing, as they say, it was a motherfucking another. But I finally got my brother on, Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black, also co-creator of Cultivated Wit, or co-founder, I mean, and you know, overall cool internet guy that kind of fell into my purview because he followed me on Twitter, and then I said, damn, this dude got a lot of followers, so I wouldn't try to find out like exactly who he is and what he does. I heard other people talking about him and stuff, and I said, yeah, this is a pretty interesting cat. Got his book, read his book, one of the only books I've read in the last few years. So therefore, you know how important it is. Baratunde, how are you doing, man?
I am doing great, Rod. Thank you so much for having me on. Sorry it's taken so long. There's all kinds of difficult situations going on in Syria and Egypt. There's all raging wildfires in Australia. There's just, you know, a lot I'm trying to handle right now. So I appreciate your patience.
Well, I understand. It's hard to be everywhere at once. And you are a man that pretty much never stops traveling anyway.
Stick and move, baby. Stick and move. You can't let them find you.
Yeah, you're like an international man of mystery to some extent. Even though
there's no mystery because I tweet every day.
Yeah, I was gonna say even though you tweet a lot, I feel like you know you're very strategic. You know, like you drop what you want and what you need people to know. But like I could not come up with a title for Baratunde Thurston. I couldn't. You know, it wasn't this one thing. You know, it's like he's an author. Yes, he's. You know, comedian of sorts, you know, have you ever done stand up? You ever tried your hand at it?
Oh yeah, man. I've been doing stand up for over a decade. That's kind of where this began.
Okay. So I now know you more for being, a person that hosts things and an author and, the person that writes stuff for, used to, you know, write stuff for like The Onion and whatnot, or, Jack and Jill Politics and stuff. Then I know that you did stand up and I've researched a lot. That's how much stuff you've done.
That's the mystery part. Yeah.
So, all right. Can we talk about your stand up, man? How'd you get your start in that?
I was a very serious kid. It was not my childhood that led to stand up. I was a little political, self-righteous dude, but I did start to find comedy. I listened to it a lot as a kid. Was on road trips. My mother and I took a lot of road trips, and we would listen to these cassette collections of like Whoopi Goldberg and Bill Cosby, and even Prairie Home Companion, old radio shows, Garrison Keillor stuff. And so I think some of that started to affect my taste in comedy early on, but I could not produce it. I was not a funny child. I was a very, very serious little boy. Then the internet came along for me in about 1993, and I started finding just lots of humor sites. They weren't even really humor sites. It was almost like pre-BuzzFeed. They were basically lists of jokes. And there would be like 100 ways to annoy your roommate, and 10 reasons a baby is like another thing. I don't even remember all these right now, but I started an email list where I would send out the best of these jokes to my friends, which was just in high school. Maybe had like 20 or 30 people on that list. And then that led to college, where I started doing the satirical newsletter, basically trying to update my friends on what was going on in the world in a way that I thought they might actually open the message and read it. It was a little early version of The Onion before I knew that it existed. I called it Newsflash, spelled with a PH, because it was fat, like baby fat. It was great. And then the stand-up thing kind of evolved out of that. I knew that I could be on stage because I had been in some kind of performance most of my life, a youth orchestra program, musicals, choir, plays. And then I had this funny voice that had evolved through writing, but never as me on stage. So merging those wasn't the obvious thing, but a friend of mine sparked my interest. Actually, he's in my book. His name is Derek Ashong. He is now with the Fusion TV Network, this new network targeting English-speaking Latino Americans. And Derek has said, in kind of in passing, that he was going to do a stand-up open mic night. This was in 2001. Yeah, 2001, because I had quit my job, which is a terrible decision. So Derek said he was going to do it, and he never did it. He never did it, and I never, like, called him when it was just one of those things. People say things. Sometimes I don't do them. I do that all the time. But it planted this little seed in my head, and I had this conversation with my then-girlfriend about my whole creative life. Basically, I didn't have one, and I used to. I used to write things and perform things, but at this point, I was a year and a half out of college, and I was working all the time and putting on weight and taking cabs and kind of living this whole other life that was absent my own real voice. And so she inspired me to rethink that, shall we say. And so I started writing. And as soon as I had made the sort of mental decision to reconnect with creating things, a lot of other opportunities opened up. One of them was a stand-up comedy class. Flipping through this adult education course catalog while I was in the bathroom in my home at the time in Somerville, Massachusetts, just outside of Cambridge. And I saw basically a $100 class to take 6 or 8 weeks every Monday night, stand-up comedy. I was like, okay, I can afford that. I have a job. I've got the time where I can make it. And so that's really where it started. And then I also found this opportunity at the same time to Tuesday night take a comedy writing workshop in Brooklyn. Mm. And this was, again, 2001. Yeah, late 2001, 2002, early 2002. And so I was commuting to Brooklyn every Tuesday from Boston to take that class, and then I was taking the stand-up class Monday nights in Boston. And those two things combined are going to give me a tremendous jump start. We had our graduating ceremony from the stand-up class, which was to perform in a real club in front of our friends and our family and a bunch of strangers who did not know what they had signed up for, which was to watch a whole bunch of newbies do their thing. And that was the beginning. I followed Sarah Silverman on my first time properly on stage doing stand-up comedy. And that was April of 2002.
Now, do you still go up from time to time?
Yeah, I do. In fact, until a year ago, I was probably doing two shows a minimum a week. Okay. I hosted a stand-up show in the East Village in New York for 5 years. I've been in New York 6 years now. So at that point, the entire time I was there, I had one show to run every week. And then I would usually get on somebody else's show. Hannibal Buress does a really great show at the Knitting Factory in Williamsburg. I do that every couple of months. There's shows in Union Hall and Littlefield in Brooklyn occasionally. There was a club called Comics, which I was somewhat regular at. They're closed now. Caroline's every once or twice a year at this point, really. And then just picking up things as they come along. What's happened since the book and starting a company, those two things don't leave a lot of time to go on stage and talk to drunk people very much.
Right.
So that has declined a lot. I probably have gone from 2-3 shows a week to 2-3 shows a month at this point. So I'm still on stage a lot doing talks at universities or conferences, or like yesterday I got to speak at the White House, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And there's humor always in my stuff, but doing sets at a stand-up club is way down on the list at this point, which makes me a little sad, but there's also only so many hours in a day.
Is it something that you feel like is it like a first love? Is it something that you plan on doing like your whole life, even if it is like, I only went up a few times this month, or maybe even if you get to the point where it's a few times a year, but you're just, it's something you'll always do?
I think so. I think it's like a practice. You know, like some people go to church every week or meditate every day, which I try to do, or do yoga every day. Like stand up is just good maintenance for my soul, especially creatively. There's a lot I get out of writing all kinds of forms of writing, whether it's a column and more formal writing that has an editor attached, or just mouthing off on Twitter at the other end of the spectrum. That satisfies a bit of my need and thirst and hunger and addiction creatively. And then there's something else I get from you know, doing longer, like I'm going to talk for an hour, you know, about this topic and be funny in it and powerful and more production, high production there. But there's very little that can replace, and I really don't know if there's anything that can replace just like a microphone and a crowd and it's nighttime and there's no props, there's just you.
Yeah.
And so I feel like part of me just needs that groundedness, you know, there's no smoke machines, maybe there's intro music, maybe.
And there's also something about instant gratification, too.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a difference between, like, putting a comedic thought out on a Facebook post or in an article versus, you know, in a comedy club or even a theatrical comedy setting. Not even, you know, club doesn't have to be the thing, but a place where people are showing up to laugh versus you're interfering in some way or hijacking or hacking their feed of life. You know, here's the thing, like when you're doing a comedy set in that setting at a theater or a club, everybody signed up for it. Like they probably paid something, they certainly have chosen. You don't have a lot of accidental consumers of stand-up comedy. Whereas on the internet, like they could be reading your article or your post right after like tragic slaughter of puppies at a mill and then right before like 15 ways cats make you more inspired about life. And so, and then like my cousin just had a baby and like my other cousin's having some problems. There is a real kind of chaotic mix of information and you never really know. You don't get to choose certainly the context, you know, of your expression, you know, on the internet. People kind of opt in on their terms. So there's something really nice about everybody kind of agreeing, we're going to do this right now. Even though some of them may be distracted temporarily by their phones, checking in about those cats.
Yeah, you know, what's funny, though, is even if, like, if you're doing a live set or whatnot, I feel like even when people have, like, their lines and their things that they, you know, I will laugh at this, this isn't funny to me, blah, blah, blah. I think in person, those lines can kind of be crossed and people can, because you don't have a second to really think and put it through a process. Well, I think online, a lot of times something might start out funny and then like someone or a group or a person gets a hold of it and they're like, well, what about this one part of it? That's not funny, is it? And everybody's like, I guess not. I shouldn't have been laughing, you know, and it kind of is like more. So it's almost, I think, harder to be funny when you're writing something because, you know, it goes through so many processes before people go, oh, okay, that was funny. You know, a lot of times people just go, it passed A, B, and C, but not, you know, E, D, and F. I didn't think that part was funny, so I'm done, you know? But that visceral laugh, like when I was a waiter, that was one of the things I liked about being a waiter, even though it wasn't the best paying gig, was the, you know, these people like me and I know because I got $10 off this table, you know, as opposed to, you know, at my job, I had to wait for like a performance review, which might come 6 months later. It's like, I don't know if I was, you know, what they thought about me until then. Another thing too, do you ever think about, maybe doing like, TV or movie or, you know, even like, you know, stand up specials or anything like that? Comedically?
Yeah, so movies don't cross my mind that much. And I mean, I like watching them. It is not a big priority to try to like write a movie or be an actor in a movie and then run down that whole path. It takes up so much time. I don't even know when I would do that or if I'd be good at doing that. Like that's two reasons that is not high on the list. TV is definitely something I've played around with a lot. I have appeared on TV in kind of pundit, analyst, comedic-type roles, dropping commentary on mostly MSNBC shows now, like Melissa Harris-Perry, Chris Hayes, lately. Prior to that, it was a lot more CNN stuff, but I think found a little bit more of a home with MSNBC over the past year and a half. And that's fun and just kind of a nice way to splash in to a bigger audience than what I already have assembled hodgepodge through the internet. And then I've hosted some shows. So 4 years ago, I hosted a show on Discovery Science Channel where I was kind of the guide and the voice of the series all about the future. Mm-hmm. I got to travel around the world and interview researchers and scientists and innovative people at certain types of businesses about what they were working on in their labs that might catch on and what our world might look like. That was fun. And I worked with Yahoo last year. I went to the political conventions to cover for them and for WNYC Public Radio out in New York, both the DNC and the RNC and the inauguration and election night, and to do a man on the street type stuff, again, sort of being a host. And sort of, you know, a lot of my stand-up training is actually often really helpful for that in terms of thinking on your feet. And right now I'm making a show for AOL, my company Cultivated Wit, mm-hmm. which is born of three of us who left The Onion a year ago. Part of what we do is create content, and we have a deal with AOL, with their video unit, to produce a web series all about crowdfunded businesses, successful crowdfunded businesses. So we're traveling around and, you know, talking to people who've been through it across a lot of different types of businesses. What worked? Why'd you do it? Would you do it again? What advice do you have for other people? This is this burgeoning method within entertainment and manufacturing and even retail, like all kinds of stuff that people are not just asking for bank loans or friends and family favors, but there's like this other option. So I love all kinds of like visual storytelling is a long way of getting at the answer to your question. In terms of a stand-up special, I'd love to do that. That takes some planning because I basically have to grind for 6 months to a year hard to be ready so that everything that hits is gold, and to have, you know, a super gold 30 minutes, which is the standard I would want, is going to take a lot of dedication. I probably would be bad at it if I was like, yeah, I want to do one next week. What's up, Comedy Central? They'd be like, and you are, what's going on here? So that's not an immediate future thing, but I, you know, would love to do that someday. I have one of my little bucket list goals is to do some kind of stand-up special thing on televised medium, whatever that means. That definition keeps changing too.
Yeah. Now what about like acting wise, like, you know, maybe like would it be too restrictive if you were like trying to be like get a part in, say, a sitcom or something like that? Would that be like something too time intensive, or, you know, is it just not something that you would dig necessarily?
You know, other than like the acting that a black man has to do every day in America, I'm not sure that is, you know, my future. I like to think I can do everything, which becomes a problem sometimes because, you know, you don't necessarily do anything well when you're so extended. The idea of acting isn't something that's really a focus of mine right now. I like being me. Mm-hmm. And I certainly like being on stage and being on camera and being on mic. Like, I'm talking to you right now. I love this. This is fun. This is like a great start to the day. Mm-hmm. But, you know, being a character in whatever, you know, How I Met Your Mother is, you know, auditioning for roles, and that's a whole nother life, mm-hmm. or probably a whole nother Baratunde. Like, if I could clone myself, then you might see Actortunde out there or Sitcomtunde. You know, working all those sets, but it's pretty difficult to keep together even the things that I've launched. I'm not, if anyone's listening out there and you're like, oh man, now I can't give this guy millions of dollars to star in my sitcom, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, come, look, we could meet at the hotel lobby and you can just hand over the millions and I will learn to act amazingly on the spot. But I'm just saying, I'm not spending a ton of my energy pursuing stuff like that. I'm really trying to follow through a bit more. On things I've learned. So we'll see. You know, next week maybe I'll be on the show. It seems unlikely.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, if nothing else, you can, if you ever do get the clone technology, you know, you have something for your clone to do already. So
that's... What a waste of a clone. You know, as I think about, I just read this story late last night about scientists doing this process called the de-extinction, where they're bringing back extinct species. Basically, Jurassic Park is becoming real. And there's a whole group of scientists like, yo, let's bring back the woolly mammoth. And I'm like, really, science? Like, of all the things that you could point your magic wand at, you're going to bring back, you know, a tusk-riddled, like, hairy elephant? I feel like there's much more we could do. So I want to check myself on that. If I could clone me, maybe putting me on TV more is not the best use of that technology. Maybe I could create a superhero version of myself, or like free people from prisons, or like just teach some kids to code or something. How about that? Yeah, that seems like more noble use of cloning technology. I feel better already. Thank God.
Yeah, I'd like a charity clone of myself where I would be able to then alleviate my conscience, you know, in case anybody ever tries to like charity check me, because I think Jay-Z just got charity checked the other day.
Oh, yes. There could be a whole Jay-Z clone that does nothing but like build schools for little broke kids. It'd be amazing.
Yep.
That little Jay-Z laugh and just like, I'm just throwing money out of balconies and just pouring people everywhere.
Anybody ever checks you, just go, hey, man, take that up with my charity clone.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure he's on
the
job.
That's a good concept. That's a good concept, charity phone. I love it.
Now, I read How to Be Black, man. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I didn't, it was one of those books I didn't think I would need to read because I am black, and I was like, I think I know how I'm doing to do this pretty well, but, you know.
Yep.
After reading, I said, you know, there were some good points in there, and there were some things I could do better. I actually enjoyed the chapter on how to be the black employee. Thought that was really good. It definitely was able to like do some things better through reading that chapter, you know, just participating at work and stuff like that. Even though I did get laid off eventually, which is fine, but I don't think that had much to do with me, but it was, you know, I still did it, you know, follow the steps and whatnot. What made you think I'm gonna write the book on how to be black? And also, did you know that that title wasn't taken yet when you started the book?
So arrogance made me write that. I'm like, yo, there needs to be a guide out there, and I'm the one to do it. This is why I was born. The book emerged from a bunch of opportunities that led up to that moment. So it actually wasn't a 5 or 10 year plan, like leading up to, like, yeah, I want to write the book called this ridiculous thing. So a couple things led to it. One, I had been working on a book concept with my Jack and Joe Politics co-founder, Cheryl Conti. And we were looking at a more politically oriented, you know, based on the brand of the site, kind of update on some kind of, like, here's some of what black people are thinking now. Here's, you know, especially, like, middle, upper middle class black folk. You know, it's not, there's a lot of media out there about black people, which is very narrow. It's like, oh, there's prisons and there's thugs and there's athletes, and that's just black America. We're good. That seems to be a lot of the media narrative around us.
Yeah.
So we had pursued a path of doing a book that would check that a bit, but that deal never quite worked out. And we put a lot of time into it, and the proposal got to some advanced stages, but things kind of fell apart. And then the 08 election caught us both up, and then there was inauguration, and then there was, like, death panels, and, you know, all kinds of stuff just got kind of ran away from us. So that didn't quite follow through. But then I had, on a parallel track, you know, I'm always talking about race in some way in my comedy, in my presentations. It's, you know, part of what I do. I guess I'm a race man. And I was given this talk at a web conference, a Web 2.0 conference, talking about Twitter and the power of hashtags. This was 4 years ago now, summer 2009. This is pretty early in the Twitter hashtag game and trending topics and all. And it was a comedic, but also sort of informative talk. Like, this stuff is happening. Political activism is happening. Comedians are riffing and creating these kind of virtual writers' rooms. And I provided a bunch of examples of hashtags that I had observed and found to be great and funny, or some that I had started, one of which was How Black Are You? With Elon James White, who runs This Week in Blackness. And is also in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Elon and I got into this battle back and forth over Twitter of who was blacker than who based on a bunch of bullshit. And it was clearly just for fun. Hundreds of other people jumped in on the How Black Are You hashtag. We were just blackjacking each other. And I highlighted a few of those in this talk. Well, you never know who's in the room. You know, to go back to where we started with the power of the live audience, there's maybe 1,000 people on the floor out in front of me, roughly. I was like, a lot of people. I don't think it was more than that. And one of those 1,000 was an editor at HarperCollins. And she was impressed and followed up. She found me through a friend of a friend and through another means, because I was, like, you know, still even then, like, running around a lot, not always the most responsive person to email, even when it's something that could change my whole life and career. But they found me, and I came in for a meeting, and they said, we think you should write a book. you have a very strong voice. We read your blog. We heard you talk at this thing. What do you want to write about? And I was like, whoa, really? Okay, cool. Because I've been writing for free forever. And that's been, like, this is weird. It was a weird conversation. I had self-published a number of books, one in print, a couple in sort of print out myself slash PDF. I email people modes. And I've been blogging generally for free. There was no real money in Jack and Joe politics or my own personal blog. Occasionally get a writing gig on a contract status, like, oh, will you contribute a piece to this? And that might be like $300, you know, which is like, oh, I got paid to write all these words. But the idea of writing a book through a publisher was just not something that was like on my target list, but it emerged as a possibility. So we had this meeting, threw out some ideas. They suggested How Black Are You as a book concept. I suggested that's a terrible idea because I just didn't, like with Elon, it was fun and there was a level of trust that we could play with that topic and understand each other and have a level of respect where we weren't actually black checking each other. It was just kind of silly. But in terms of titling a book like that and branding myself like that, like, do I want to launch into the world challenging people's blackness? Nah, that's just too open to misinterpretation and like watermelon grape soda jokes. I didn't think that that was gonna fly. So then I was like, maybe a social media book, because like, this was born out of a Twitter talk. And I was like, nah, we got enough of those. A lot of people have done that. It'd be hard to be very original in there. And then one of the editors in the room, in fact, the publisher of this particular division, said, what about How to Be Black? And I was like, yes. Yes, I like that. I like that very much. I think that sounds ridiculous. And I had mentioned to them this other concept of a book that Cheryl and I have been working on. And we sort of jumped off from that point. So it would be something kind of race-related, How to Be Black, just sang. And then the name had not been used. There is another book that has the howtobeblack.com domain, actually, which is How to Be Black, but only on the weekends. And it's a self-published book by this couple. I think they're a couple out of the Los Angeles area. And I briefly was like, yo, let me get that domain name from you. And they're like, yo, you should pay us a lot of money. And I was like, nah, I'm good. I didn't put up a fight at all, which I might regret in the future, but hopefully they're doing well. It really didn't affect me, I don't think. So I bought howtobeblack.me, and I thought that I could help personalize it, too, and just sort of have the message be, like, there is that of blackness in all of us that we're all kind of seeking to be our authentic selves, to use a little bit of Oprah language. And How to Be Black was an excuse to really write about self-concepts and self-confidence and self-identity, whether or not you're black. It could be how to be gay, how to be a woman, how to be whatever. Black was my particular variable. So the book, sorry to run on so long, but it's kind of a cumulative story of all these past things, like blogging for years on JJP, heavily about politics and race, doing stand-up and talking about my own personal story, having this Twitter talk lead to a discussion at Harper, having an incomplete book project that then kind of gave a jumping-off point to this book project, and Cheryl's in this book, by the way, is one of my black panel members. So all that led up to this opportunity, and it just kind of worked out. And the goal was never to be like, yo, this is the one way to be black. Right. Obviously, you read it, you know that. But for anyone listening, it's in the humor section of your local bookstore or your, you know, global website, more likely. And it's a memoir. And I wanted to be able to personalize this discussion of blackness, particularly, and race in America in general, and then use humor to get in some of those awkward corners of conversation that we don't know how to have, that we refuse to have, that we feel awkward or about having, that we don't like to have, because we've been through a lot of stuff in America, but we don't like to look back very much,
right?
And really like deal with it, and it's hard. Like, black people get really offended, and it's painful stuff, and there's some things that we don't want to deal with, and white people get, you know, super hyper, I'm a good person, and then they feel like any conversation of race is necessarily like an attack on an individual character and a claim that they secretly want to own slaves today. And like, I don't even, no, I hate slavery. It's very bad. It's very bad. It's like, no, we're not. It doesn't have to be like that. And then there's more, there's like other shades of people are like, yo, what about us, son? What about us? We're coming for you. We are coming for you.
So yeah.
There's a lot going on.
I always kind of feel like, anyone that's socially conscious on any level has to have kind of a collective hate for white folks anyway. And I don't mean that in some like well, let's go burn the white people. But it's just like, you know, they, looking through history, unfortunately, they are like, you know, the Patriots in the NFL. They won all the games, and the other teams are like, hey, man, we like to, you know, a couple W's, like a Super Bowl or two. And, you know, it's, I just think if you're aware of history, you're going to have a healthy distaste, you know, but I don't think that that means that individually you hate all white people, or even collectively now that means people hate all white people. But people get so uptight that secretly that's like what everyone's harboring, this like inner Black Panther that is going to go like hurt everybody because of just, you know, black rage, motherfucker. And I don't, like, I think if people could get over that, it'd be easier to like even have a discussion. But I think if you even broach the topic of like, well, you know, the government is this, and it's like, well, what are you trying to say? What do you really mean? What are you going to do? Burn down my house? Are you going to stand outside of polling district with a stick or something? Like, it's like, no, I just, you know, wanted to talk about this issue, you know? When it comes to how to be black, there's three things. Number one, I like that you left a space for me to personally sign it for myself.
Good. So that means, you know, I already know what you got, a print edition of the book.
Yeah. You saved me a lot of time from like actually having to like stand in line at a book signing. You know, we don't have to have that awkward exchange of, you know, I really like the book. I really like writing the book. You know, I signed it myself and go send you a picture on Twitter. Like, hey, man, thanks. The other thing, for people that like physical copies of a book, and like to go to the bookstore, it is the most awkward book I've ever had to pick up in my life, because I had to go to that desk and go, yeah, I'm looking for, How to Be Black by Betude Thurston. And the lady looked at me like, sir, you're already doing it.
Pretty well.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you're kind of scaring the customers, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But, that was awkward. And then they didn't have the book. So that meant she had to like go. It was like the first day it was out. So she had to go back. She did all this research, and then she comes back. She's like, sir, we don't have How to Be Black. And it's like this, you know, young white lady telling me, like, I don't have the instruction guide to how to be black, in front of all these like white people. And I'm just thinking like, I should have looked this up online. Well, thanks, ma'am. You know, but that was cool. And then the other thing, the last thing is, it definitely sparks the most, conversations of any book I've ever had. Cause I would take it out with me and read when I, you know, eat a meal or something. And it, without fail, it didn't matter what race the person was or anything, almost every waitress, and almost any person that saw my table would be like, so what is that book about? What is, you know, like, what are you reading? And you know, of course, every white person made the, if I read it, well, can I read it too? Joke, you know, it's like, actually you can. The first chapter is about that. Yeah, man, I really like it as a conversation starter, man. It's really great.
So glad to hear all those points. That was the goal. You know, the title, it popped in the room. It felt so absurd. I was like, yes, I have to embrace this. And because I'm using humor, I feel like I can get away with it. The design of the cover, that wasn't the original concept. I had an idea. Harper had an idea. We were both wrong. Mm. I thought I had a very literal concept, like, oh, I'm teaching here. And this is sort of for black people. It's a refresher course. For non-black people, it's like, welcome to the new, you know, the new black people. And here's what here's what your media is not telling you. Here's what we're thinking. Here's what your coworkers are thinking. And so we staged a photo shoot at this old Catholic school with these tiny little desks with the arm/table you kind of have to squeeze into, linoleum, like wood. And we had this multiracial cast of folks that were in the shot. But it ended up looking really serious. It looked like I was giving a lecture on education reform. that wasn't going to fly. And then Harper was like, oh, it's a comedy, so we should have like a brick wall and a microphone because comedy, you know, like a comedy. And then like wacky fonts with like explosion lines around them because, you know, it's like a comedy, like a stand-up comedy club. You're a stand-up comedian, so people will know it's funny because the title is like kind of, you know, it's kind of scary, so we should make sure people know it's funny. And that looked bad.
Yeah.
And so I dug deep into myself. And actually, I took a bit of a page from things I learned at The Onion for the physical design, which is understatement. You know, one of the reasons that The Onion worked is the dryness of it. The onion's not wacky. You know, right. It's not a hoax. It's not like, hey, everybody check it out, 15 ways wide, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, you know, you have black man given nation's worst job. Like, that's the headline. It's dry. It's written AP tone. And the humor is because it has such a design sort of metaphor taken from straight news. It looks straight, and therefore it is funny.
Right.
And so I thought, well, okay, can we do that with How to Be Black? Not make it look like news, but just make it look as simple and clean as possible. You don't really need any imagery. The title is ridiculous. So how do we make that play that up? All right, Helvetica. Let's go with, like, the straightest font there is. Make it bold. Black on white. I want it to be legible across a room. And I wanted, what you experienced, I wanted to force conversation. I wanted to force choice and awkwardness. Because this whole conversation is kind of forced and awkward.
Right.
And I wanted some kind of physical metaphor for that. And then the other twist we did, and I don't know if you've seen in person, maybe in pictures online, but for the hardcover, half of the books are black ink on white
yes.
background. Half are white ink on black background. And that was also a conscious choice. Like, I wanted to play around with the idea of, like, who owns blackness? And is there, even in the physical book design, there is no one way to even print How to Be Black, much less to actually be black. So that's, it was all, part of the visual success of the book were those choices, but they weren't the initial choices. They were where we landed mm-hmm. after a couple of failed paths that both looked a little too weird.
I like the idea of the comedian cover, because if I saw like a stand up or something and it said How to Be Black over the title, I would assume it was just those jokes about, you know, white people do this, black people do that. You know, just a whole book of just, which would have been, the longest How to Be Black, as far as, white people do this, black people do that joke of all time is like 300 pages of, now let's talk about driving your car, chapter two, you know?
So,
the other thing too, I think you stumbled onto a gold mine, and I don't know, you know, if anybody's told you this yet, but you realize you could like make at least like 10 or 12 more of these books very easily if you just go to the search and replace function and just change like black to Asian or, you know, white. You know, you don't even have to rewrite most of the book. You just change the race and resell the book over and over again. I think it'll take 2 to 3 more books before people catch on to what you're doing. But, you know, you can make millions of dollars, man.
I've definitely thought about it. So the day we agreed on the title, I bought up all the other domains that I could.
Mm-hmm.
How to be brown dot everything, how to be gay dot everything, how to be Asian, yellow, Desi, Latin. So just as a anticipation, and certainly the feedback on the book, a woman came up to me. I was in San Francisco for like 5 days, just up until yesterday, actually. And we hosted a Whiskey Friday event, these meetups that my company and I host, generally involving like tech people and media people and comedy people with no real agenda, just to hang out and on Friday drink some whiskey. This woman came, she saw the tweet, she's like, oh, I got to show up. She's 45 years old, white woman. I don't know where she grew up, but she moved to Silicon Valley in the 80s, well before it was a hot thing to do. She's been involved in so much tech stuff, and she feels out now because Silicon Valley has such a youth obsession, such a young men obsession, and it's about apps and kids, and she's like, that's not me, but there's, like, I'm a proper computer scientist, like, I do have something to contribute, and just being the only woman at the table in so much of the Silicon Valley discussion feels a lot like what you wrote about in How to Be Black, and she's like, I don't know if you ever thought of this, but this could be how to be a 45-year-old white woman in Silicon Valley, and so, yeah, I thought about it going in, but to some degree, I've planned for growth of it. I haven't taken a lot of steps in that direction, but I am working with my editor and an agent on some possibilities there. I think it's less about me writing other versions and more about the more I'm out in the world and doing especially live events and people kind of rolling up on me or people writing into the Tumblr, which is howtobeblack.me.
Right.
You see, like, the echoes of some of my experience gone, you know, through other communities. And I couldn't touch on everything. I mean, I didn't really talk about religion at all. Because right. religion hasn't been a big part of my black experience in terms of black church type stuff, because my mother wasn't into church like that. So I had like Buddhism and Episcopalianism and Catholicism, all kinds of stuff mixing in my stuff. There's no military stuff going on. There's really no sports stuff, because mm-hmm. it's mostly a memoir, and I'm not that into sports. So my How to Be Black doesn't involve a ton of playing of sports. It sometimes involves some justification of why I don't play sports. But there's so many different ways, you know, to talk about this within blackness, much less, you know, within every other group and micro group there is. One of the best shows that I was a part of, there's probably like five highlights to the live events around the book, but even this amongst those five is pretty high. It was in L.A., and a woman named Fanny Wilson, I think her last name is Wilson, she is a playwright, and she writes TV stuff, and she does one-woman shows. She's from Kenya, I want to say, a pretty upper-class family in Kenya, and then she immigrated to the U.S., and she had a concept that was very similar to what we've just been talking about, how to be blank. And so we did a How to Be Blank show in L.A. with a bunch of other performers. There was How to Be a Gay Catholic Woman. There was How to Be a Fat American Virgin. There was How to Be a Mormon Gay Man. There was How to Be a Rich, you know, Kenyan Girl, and I closed it out with How to Be Black, but it was like an excuse to bring all these other folks together and do kind of this identity show that, you know, didn't take identity so seriously, but used humor as a way to get to some serious stuff. Definitely, there's a whole tour. Like, we probably just crafted, you know, a TV show, a live tour, like at least, you know, 5 books, if not 15. Mm-hmm. A podcast, Empire. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do, so you can see why I'm not.
It's like, okay, that's, yeah. You're like, actually, I wrote one book, and that was hard. So, you know, there, and then, of course, you know, even if you just want to go back to the well and not even have to write a new book, you could always do the Dummies Guide to How to Be Black, where, you know, it's just a lot more simpler. And that probably wouldn't even take that much work. You just strip out some stuff. So, you know, it's always a way to, you know, to keep plugging away and make that money. Speaking of plugging, you unplugged from the internet for 25 days. I actually just listened to your podcast about unplugging from the internet for 25 days. I also listened to your Fruitvale Station episode. Unplugging from wait, hold on. What was that sound about the Fruitvale Station one? What was that?
No, that was just like, that's still such a raw movie as I think back to it. That was a heavier episode of my little impromptu podcast than is usual.
Yeah, I read when you got out of it and you like wrote a post on Facebook about it and stuff, and you know, it was very moving and compelling, and it was like, you know, people, you know, everybody needs to go see this movie. And I think, and a lot of people have had that reaction to it, and my reaction has been like, hell no. Like, I feel like, have you seen the movie The Avengers?
No.
All right, well, in the end of, well, I don't want to spoil it, but there's something that happens in The Avengers with the Hulk, and the whole movie they're trying to figure out, like, how the fuck can you control not just being the Hulk all the time? You know, that's the thing with the Hulk, is the Hulk just bust out and you're like, oh no, the Hulk's here. You know, we thought we were having tea with Dr. Banner, and now the fucking Hulk showed up, right? And he gets to the end, and then they're like, you know, how do you control? And he said, the secret is I'm always angry. And that's how I feel about this shit. It's like, I'm always angry. But I've seen so many people say it's an important film and that people should see it, but I think I'm too angry to go see it. I could barely handle like regular stuff at this point, but I'll see it sometime on DVD or something, because I don't doubt that it's great, because Michael B. Jordan is the man. It has been for quite a while, so I think it is an important story to be told. Maybe I'll buy a ticket and then go see some bullshit where I can relax.
I had a couple people say that, you know, to me. I mean, mostly, you know, black people who already know what's up. But, like, I get it. You know, I was there or I was there something very similar. I don't really need more reasons to be sad,
right?
Or more reasons to be angry at America right now, or at the police right now, or at white people right now, whatever.
Yeah, and so listening to you, like, your reaction to it is almost like I could just see myself having that reaction. And it was like, yeah, I don't want to be there. and you know what? The people that are going there are taking it so much better than me. Like, I just feel like it would be the end of, Do the Right Thing. And I'd be throwing trash cans through the movie theater window, like Radio Raheem and shit like that. So, now the most important question I want to ask you about unplugging, because I didn't hear you talk about this in the article and I haven't seen you tweet about it. Did you unplug from pornography? That is the question. That's the $25 million question right there, man. That's the hardest one to unplug from.
That's a much higher price than I think is deserved. I did, but I also need to clarify, the unplugging wasn't from the entire internet. The
right.
unplugging was from all social media internet stuff and all email and work. I still use the internet.
Okay.
I watched Homeland that I watched from some streaming channel. I watched Netflix. I got some stuff off of iTunes. I caught up on my stories, basically, because I had been falling well behind. Got caught up on Scandal. Got caught up on Breaking Bad and everything else. And I use the internet as I normally would to, like, order food and movie tickets and make my life more convenient and better. I just didn't engage in all the chit-chat and the back and forth. I didn't use it as a social platform. So I still texted friends. I still saw my friends. And I was able to, like, allow myself to talk on the phone, to send text messages, and to use the internet kind of as a utility. But I never logged on to any of the social stuff. Or email, which is amongst the most social platforms we have and the most exhausting.
Okay.
But yeah, the porn thing, that wasn't the big test, actually.
Okay.
It turns out it was much more of can I, like, not mouth off all the time about everything that I'm thinking and doing.
So it's not even if it was a part, it wouldn't have been the I'm not watching pornography. It would have been like, I'm not telling anybody that I'm watching pornography. On Twitter, Facebook, social media, and other stuff. The other thing, like, I got some speed round questions I want to ask. Like, how do you feel about the N-word? Yes or no?
Mostly no. Mostly don't care.
Oh, okay.
And I think always no for white people. Always no.
Right. Right. What about, I don't know if you saw, I don't know how you couldn't have saw, like, you know, Don Lemon got in, like, some quote unquote hot water, depending on what side you're on. Like, some people, are doing, like, attaboy about time somebody told black people the dang shit. So, how do you feel about, like, Don Lemon's comments? And, like, I noticed that in all the places that I read you and follow you, you normally don't have any of the quote unquote tough love speeches of, you know, pull your pants up and do this and do that. Is that a conscientious choice that you decided not to do that? Or is it just that I don't really share those views? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I don't really share those views. I mean, the idea of, and I would highly recommend everybody read Cord Jefferson's piece on white on white crime that he put up on, I believe, Gawker earlier this week. He was on Chris Hayes earlier this week. Just a very satirical, very, great take on this whole discussion of X on X criminality.
Mm-hmm.
But, so yeah, I think there's a level of condescension, heavy judgment, sort of like elderly Bill Cosby-esque lecturing that comes from, oh, but also we know, yeah, black people, you don't do well by yourself, so let's not focus on the institutional stuff. The way it comes down in my head is, telling people to pull their pants up or speak better or just be better isn't useful, and it's sort of easy because it ignores how we got to where we got to. And the challenge is to take in all the history. And nobody really wants to know, oh, why are you going to bring history up again? It's not about history. It's about little black boys not talking right and hanging out on the stoop and not being productive members of society. But why is that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, where are the jobs, right? Where are the models? Where is the family? Where is... When you have an entire law enforcement apparatus, which is telling you ain't shit, that your life is literally worthless, And here are the opportunities you have when everything is funneling you into a machinery of self-destruction. Those choices make a lot more sense. And so just like going on air and being like, you just have to be better. Just be smarter. Just work harder. What's wrong with you? A lot of that comes out of a culture, but it also comes out of a context that isn't isolated. It's not just about individual choice added up to community choice. It's about a community and a system which drives individual choices down these really perverse paths. So when someone like Don Lemon goes up, and it's not just him, he's the man of the moment.
Right. Yeah. You know, that was the funny thing is like a lot of people that were given that, you know, talk props were like, well, nobody says this. And I wrote like a satirical piece about it, called, Don Lemon has a point, but I have 10 more where I go on to add my 10 points. But it's part of the research for it. I just searched like, you know, like people that have done these speeches to the black community. And within like 10 minutes, I think I found at least 10 of just, and this is why Negroes fucked up. And here's some more black people didn't do this right. And it's like, well, this isn't that uncommon.
No, and I mean, I even addressed it in the book when I, you know, the chapter, How to Be the Next Black President, was, you know, my attempt to walk this razor line between like, yay, Obama, and like, oh man, Obama. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, especially as a first, like, he's got a, just bear this cross of expectations which can never be satisfied by any other communities he's supposed to be representing. And sometimes that's an understandable excuse, but sometimes it's just fucking frustrating.
Yeah.
And so whenever, you know, the president gives a tough love speech, like, oh, I see what you're doing. You got a whole bunch of white people watching you. You got to make sure that they don't think that you're playing favorites and that you will smack a Negro at the drop of a pen so that they feel comfortable in their own.
Right. Place. He's like, you know what? The president is like when a comedian goes on stage, when he talks about black people like that, he's like when a comedian goes on stage and says, like, I just got married. And everybody's like, yeah. Or I just had a kid, because like the crowd that he's talking to, which always is bigger than the actual physical crowd. He could be talking to Morehouse, but it's like, and black people got to get their stuff together and we got to work hard. The virtual other crowd, the white people that are watching the black person talk to other black people, are just kind of like, yeah, they got to work hard. Yeah, they got to believe in American dream. And the second that he's actually like, and speaking of which, I'm black and people clutch their purses around me sometimes. It's like, what? No, you dividing America.
No, people love, I mean, it is the, it's pandering,
yeah.
You know, and it's the easy crowd pleasing thing. It's like saying, oh, we got some good-looking ladies in the house tonight. We'll give it up for the ladies.
Right.
Or who likes weed? Like, nobody's going to be like, boo, enjoyment. You know, like, it just doesn't work that way. So you got an easy win when you do that. But there is a cost to it. And I think what I was getting to with the earlier thing is you kind of have to go deeper and that's not fun all the time, and it's hard. And we don't like, you know, we're a nation built on shortcuts. Like, we fast-tracked our economy on free exploited labor. We, you know, took someone else's investment, the people who are already here, like, yo, you don't want that. Look, we found ourselves a nation. Like, you like took something. So it's not surprising in a historical or cultural context that we continue to make the easy path. We make baby wet wipes because we're too lazy to add water to a napkin ourselves. Like, this is that nation. It's like, oh, we want to put our peanut butter in our jelly inside of our bread all in one. Like, why do I have to work
right.
to even eat my bad food? Like, unhealthy food is being made more easily. Just, like, shoot it into your face.
Right.
So it's not surprising we don't want to take, like, the long road to the race conversation. Like, oh, just tell black people to pull their pants up? That's all I got to do?
Yeah, we're a nation that decided that instead of learning how to twerk, we will reinvent the twerk and Harlem Shake and call it and just do some other shit, but call it that.
Yeah, we're like living the name already. That's got a strong brand. So why don't we just redo that? It's hard to build a noob dance.
Right.
You know, we'll just take that one.
Yeah.
SEO is strong.
Yeah, YouTube wasn't around for much of that, so you know, we can easily make 20 more, you know, Harlem Shake YouTube videos, and nobody will even find those old things when they go look it up. Well, this has been awesome, man. I wanted to talk to you for a while. It's been great to, you know, to finally catch up with you, as a man that is, you know, globetrotting, obviously. It's like, where in the world is Baratunde Thurston today? And, you know, as also a person that, you know, I think you might be the first person I've interviewed on the show that has been inside the White House and, done stuff. Yeah. So that's big for me.
It's amazing. It's an honor. You feel like everything is significant. Like I drank water from the water fountain at the White House. I'm like, I'm drinking White House water. What? It's pretty cool. It encourages one to act the fool.
Right. Like you probably don't regularly record dog shitting, but it was
No. But boom. This is the first dog. You know what I mean? Like, it's historic.
That's awesome. One more question before you leave. What countries have you been to? I remember wondering this because I know you travel a lot. I was like, wonder where all this man has been.
That's a list. All right, so let me try to think about this from a in out. So Canada, Mexico, Trinidad and Tobago, Brazil. That's in the Americas. Then I'm gonna go across the Atlantic, Norway, the UK, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, France, Turkey, Senegal, Cameroon, the Republic of Georgia in Eastern Central Europe, and then keep spinning, Japan, Australia, India. I think I wasn't counting, but
wow,
there's a chance I left somebody off, but that's pretty accurate.
That is a lot of places, dude.
Yes, it is. I last year I was in 6 countries, 34 cities. I was gone half the time. It's one of the best parts of my life is that I get to travel so much, and it's one of the things I love most about America is that I get to leave it, and it helps. It'll put things in context. It also helps me appreciate a lot of things that, you know, staying still doesn't, you know, and you can apply that super locally. Like leaving your neighborhood is a great thing if you don't really get to do that. Like go to the other side of town, go to Staten Island, go to wherever it's far, but still kind of within your range. So even within New York City, I try to move around a bit. So there's a level of exhaustion that comes with it, but mostly it's an extreme privilege to be able to move about so freely. It's like I have a global pass.
It's crazy because it's like
the magic of a U.S. passport is part of that, and just the way my life has evolved.
It's crazy because like the boy from the humble beginnings of that first chapter and How to Be Black is like everywhere. You know what I mean? Like that's crazy. Considering how many other people share that same story, that same come up in America, but you know, don't end up able to, you know, go out and see all these things. So it's almost like you're getting to go see all these things for all these other people that might not ever make it or inspire them to go make it, you know? So
it's
big.
It's both of those things. Like that little boy is traveling with me, you know, like I still have a sense of wonder. I've been to the White House a couple of times over the past 2 years, and I want to maintain the wonder, because if that becomes regular, like, oh man, that's not, there's some kind of problem with that. And at the same time, I think part of the reason I shout so much online is just like, yo, everybody come with me. Like, check this out. Yeah. Like, I'm about to go here. Boom. And what am I learning? And can, I don't even know what, I don't even control what others are learning because of my experience there. People might be picking up a bunch of things that I'm not even intentionally putting down. So yeah, it's fun. It's exhausting. It's occasionally expensive, but because of the way my life works, a lot of it is people bringing me places. So I don't bear the brunt of the cost a lot of the time. And then, it's somewhat a level of responsibility. I thank you so much, for having me on.
No problem, man.
I'm a fan. Keep it up.
I will.
And, I'll see you in the future. Maybe when I'm coming through North Carolina.
Yes, sir, man. Thank you. If you come through Charlotte or somewhere in the nearby area, I'll definitely look to check you out. Everybody, make sure you go check him out, too. You should be following him on Twitter already. He's just at Baratunde. It's a very unique name. Of course, I have it linked. Like I also said, you can check him out at Cultivated Wit. And don't forget How to Be Black, man. That, like I said, is a great book. I read it. And you guys know I don't recommend anything that I don't believe in. So you should all go read it too. And check out his podcast. He does it like once every time he feels like it. And you can go, you can go listen to it too. All right, man. Well, until next time, guys, thanks for listening to Medium Talk on the Blackout Test Premium Network. Peace.